How is it that we find ourselves surrounded by such complexity, such elegance?
The genes of you and me,
the genes of you and me,
we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA. We're all made of DNA.
Hi, you're listening to DNA Today, a multi-award-winning podcast and radio show where we discover new advances in the world of genetics. From genetic technology like CRISPR to rare diseases to new research, for over a decade, DNA Today has brought you the voices of leaders in genetics in over 200 episodes. For the past 3 years, DNA Today has won the People's Choice Best Science and Medicine Podcast Award. I'm Kira Dineen. I'm a certified genetic counselor and your host. Joining us now is Sarita Edwards, who is the CEO and president of the EWE Foundation, which is a global healthcare advocacy organization for families living with trisomy 18, also known as Edwards syndrome, and other rare diseases. She is an award-winning advocate, global speaker, and host of the Being Rare podcast. I love having fellow podcast hosts on. We had one recently, Dr. Patrick Short. So thank you so much, Sarita, for coming on the show.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
And we actually connected because you were listening to an episode of DNA Today and then you reached out. That was episode 228 about trisomy 13 and 18. And I learned so much in that episode. I really recommend for people to go check it out. We'll put that in the show notes. And, you know, I figured we'd kind of start with you and your family's story and then kind of get more into learning about your foundation. So your son is Elijah. You have a couple of kids, but we're mostly talking about Elijah today. So could you kind of take us through how you first learned that Elijah could have trisomy 18 and kind of when was this, if it was during your pregnancy or after his birth, of just taking people through like your first part of the journey?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, for us, we actually, Elijah is our fifth child. But he was my sixth pregnancy. We actually had miscarried once as well. But Elijah was child number five, and things were going normal up until about 22 weeks. Just a routine ultrasound in our OB office showed some anomalies, and they had some concerns, and so they recommended that we see maternal fetal medicine. And a physician from a neighboring city actually provided MFM care in our area. And we scheduled an appointment for when he was going to be back in town and saw him. And that's when we learned about Elijah's diagnosis. I was probably 23, 24 weeks when we actually saw him. It was about 22 weeks when we had that abnormal ultrasound. You know, for us, it was, I don't think we really knew what to expect. Having had four other children prior to Elijah, you know, for us, it was just the normal screens and everything. And then we were told about this condition. They really just told us the name of it was, you know, Edwards syndrome. Most folks know it as trisomy 18. I had worked in healthcare about 22 years at that point, and I had never heard of the diagnosis. The description that they gave us was catastrophic. You know, we were told to not really expect him to survive, you know, prenatally. You know, we were told honestly that he would pass away in utero during the delivery process or shortly after birth. And so that really kind of kickstarted our journey to trying to figure out what this diagnosis is, what it means for our unborn child, what it means for us. But at that time, we were being prepared for him to not survive.
And that must have just been so heartbreaking and surprising, having four healthy kids, it sounds like, before Elijah, and the types of the approach that the healthcare providers had with you was, sounds like, using terms like lethal, and that we, you know, don't expect this pregnancy to make it to term. Did it seem like more of a finality there of this is what is going to happen? Was there any conversations of it being more of terms like life limiting and that there's a high chance for miscarriage or a stillbirth? Like, you know, to me, it sounds like they were saying, you know, you will have a miscarriage or, you know, a stillbirth, that they didn't at least kind of highlight what else could happen.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It was very much a matter of fact delivery in terms of, this is what you can expect. We, you know, we even started to ask those questions ourselves. And we were told, one of our physicians actually had a printout of information for us to read about the diagnosis. And they said it's 95-96% that this ends in death. And so they were, I felt like, stripping the little pieces of hope that I was trying to hold on to. It seemed as if they were trying to, I don't know, just make us, if you will, not expect anything but death. Like that was the only alternative. And even when we asked if there are possibilities for something different, we were always just redirected to that same narrative that, you know, these babies don't survive. And if they do, it's with so many different challenges. I mean, you'll do good to get to take him home. It's just, that was just the conversation.
And that is something that, unfortunately, I hear a lot, you know, in terms of healthcare providers often not having updated information on trisomy 18, and that healthcare has changed so much. And especially if we have a prenatal diagnosis, we can expect and prepare of what that can happen. And I remember in episode 228 that I mentioned is kind of how we connected, you know, learning that of non-mosaic trisomy. So, and I believe that's what Elijah has, right? He has, you know, what we consider like full trisomy 18. Is that correct?
That's correct. He has full trisomy 18.
Okay. For people that, you know, theoretically all of their cells have the extra chromosome there, that, you know, patients with trisomy 18 and trisomy 13 is kind of the stat I was learning, that survive to hospital discharge, like after birth and go home, that the median age of survival is nearly 15 years. And I just remember, I originally learned this at a conference and I was shook. I was like, oh my gosh. Like, you know, as you said, a lot of pregnancies that we've identified trisomy 18, many of them do end in a miscarriage or a stillbirth. But of people that survive that, it's very different statistics and a very different outlook. And I think that's something that providers are not often sharing. And it's really frustrating because it sounds like that was your experience of not talking about that. And, you know, and I'm wondering, and, you know, for those listening, we have talked a little ahead of time just to see what, you know, you felt comfortable talking about, but, you know, do you feel comfortable sharing a little bit about, you know, more conversations you had with providers in terms of if they brought up termination as an option, of just how those conversations went, how much they either revisited that or just kind of kept telling you and your partner, like, you know, this is what we're looking at, and not focusing on that other aspect of, what if this baby is born and is discharged from the hospital? Of what does life look like? Because that is something that people really do need to be educated on and have those questions answered.
Oh, I agree. I mean, I agree wholeheartedly. I think for us, it was the very first visit in the at our OB office, it was more of a, this is what it is. And it was almost like, you know, here's a printout of information. They had highlighted what we needed to focus on. They told us not to Google it. And of course, that was the first thing I did when I left the office.
Yep, everybody does.
Right. And it was like, I think it was that visit was more letting us process it, you know, like let us process what it means and what this is, read over all of this information. And so the next visit, which routinely would have been maybe 6 weeks out, it actually ended up being maybe a week or two. It was sooner than previous. And so we get back to that appointment, and that's when it becomes the conversation of, what would you like to do? You know, there are options. What are you thinking? So it was that type of language. The word terminate was never said to us. It was never stated by anyone. We were just reminded of the high mortality And we were reminded of, if our son lived, the challenges that would come with it. And so we elected to see it through to the end. And then that's when the conversation shifted a little bit to, but do you realize this is what you're dealing with? Do you realize this is what can happen if you continue to carry this child to term? And, you know, we said, well, you know, we still want to carry him to term. And then the conversation, you know, became, you want to notice movement, notice, you know, if there are so many movements per day, if within an hour and all this kind of stuff. And so at this time I was still working a full-time job outside of the home. Not only
parenting four kids,
right. The eldest kid was getting ready to head off to college. So we were preparing him for college. And not only was I working in corporate, I was in a leadership role. I had a team of 23 employees. And so I'm trying to navigate all of that. And now this pregnancy with this diagnosis. And, it got to be a lot. And I think, I think in those moments, all we had was what we were being told, right? Like all we knew was what they were telling us. It was not something that we were ready to just kind of talk about. We were protective in sharing it with the kids. We were trying to figure out what it all meant. And we felt like we were being pressured to make a decision. When we had said, we just want to see it through, whatever that means, we want to see it through. And so, I often tell people that it was every doctor's visit was like pulling a scab off of a healing wound. It it starts the bleeding all over again. It got to where I was sick and tired of going to the doctor. I hated going to my OB appointments because I knew we were going to have those same conversations over and over and over again. And then now I have the added pressure of trying to remember, did he move? Did they say 20 times an hour or 25? Did I count? How many times did he move? And it's just the mental health. Let me tell you, we were not talking about mental health like we talk about it now. Looking back.
Yeah, because this was about 8 years ago, because Elijah's going to be 7 right, soon.
I'm telling you, it was a lot. It was definitely a lot. So yeah, they never used the language terminate. They just strongly reminded us of
like alluded to ending the pregnancy as an option.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's okay. An option, yeah. For you.
I can't imagine how frustrating that is to express that that's not something you're interested in and be asked repeatedly at appointments. Well, do you understand the severity of this? Are you sure? From my perspective, and you know, I am a prenatal gent counselor. I don't know if I said that at the top. That once a patient expresses that they're not interested in that, I don't bring it up again. They know that they could ask me about that. But if a patient and their partner or support person has said, you know, we're not interested in that, we're switching gears. We're talking about management. We're talking about, you know, I think it's important that everybody understands options they have. But once that's expressed, it's like, okay, we've checked the box. We've moved on. They understand that that's an option.
Agreed.
That's not something someone's going to forget about.
Right. Exactly.
And I want to go back a little bit because you said at 22 weeks is when, you know, some differences on the ultrasound were noticed for Elijah. I'm surprised that earlier in the pregnancy, did you have any genetic screening or anything? I mean, again, this was 8 years ago, so it is a little bit different from today. But was there anything that was different before then of looking back of, oh, he was small for his size or a different types of screening came back that were, you know, a little bit, different in that sense?
No, I don't, not that I can recall. I think everything seemed normal up until that point. I mean, I think, you know, just the early onset of symptoms for just myself were completely different than my four other kids. I had really, really bad pain. But I mean, I was considered advanced maternal age too, you know, with Elijah.
Lovely term.
Right? I mean, call me old without calling me old, right? But
yeah. Can't we just say it what it is? You're this age at delivery. Do we need to put an extra label on it? Like I tend not to even say the term. I'm like, you're X age at delivery. You know, this is the chance, to have a baby with a certain chromosome condition.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. But I don't recall us having any conversations or anything up until that point. Everything just, it seemed super, super normal. And then boom, there we were.
And when you had some of these conversations with the healthcare providers, like, you know, the MFM you mentioned, was there an option that was brought up of having further testing to confirm the diagnosis of trisomy 18? Is that something that was offered to you, like a amniocentesis or a CVS?
It was. They actually, they told us that we could do a blood test. They told us that we could do an amniocentesis, but they did tell us an extensive list of risks. And so we were, you know, wavering. They did say the amnio would better confirm what we were, you know, what we had been told. And so because of the risk that they presented after giving us all of the risk that comes with the trisomy 18 diagnosis, we chose to do the blood test. And honestly, we had already made up our minds that we were going to see it through to the end anyways. And so we didn't want to put myself or Elijah at further risk by doing the amnio. So we elected for the blood test, and it came back, you know, showing the same thing, the markers for trisomy 18. And then we honestly just took it to turn.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that, you know, really shows that healthcare providers do need to be providing options and whatever is best fit for you and your family, that for you guys having a diagnosis through an amniocentesis didn't give you any extra information that was important at the time, that having the blood screening was probably the non-invasive prenatal screening saying that there's a high chance for trisomy 18 to be there, that was useful for you and your partner and your family, and that's what you needed. And an amnio wasn't going to be helpful at that point. And I think kind of like for healthcare providers to recognize, okay, this is where a patient's at. And as long as you've explained that to patients and they are like, yep, I understand. I don't have any questions about it. It's like, great. You know, we're good here in terms of where we're at. So once you had the blood screening and we're like, okay, there's a high chance Elijah has trisomy 18, what were some of the conversations in terms of management of, oh, should we do, you know, extra ultrasounds? You know, you talked about counting movements. Was there anything else that they kind of mentioned in terms of, you know, considerations with delivery or after delivery? Or were things really focused on checking in with you? Are you sure you want to continue your pregnancy?
Everything was checking in with me. We at a certain point, they stopped talking about options. And my doctor's appointment really just became, you know, I would do the extensive heart monitoring. You know, they check for the heart or listen for like the heartbeat. I actually went from...
You sit there, read a book, you have a band on you.
Exactly.
Yep, to look at the fetal monitoring of the heart rate.
Yeah, so my visits really became that, you know, just that extensive heart monitoring process. And then I found myself going more frequently. And then it was probably about 28, 29 weeks. My local OB, they said, you know, we don't think the hospital here can accommodate this, so we want to transition you. So they transitioned me to a hospital 2 hours away, which is, you know, where we moved from. And so I was familiar with that hospital. My four other children were born at that hospital. So to some degree, I was kind of excited to go there. But when I got there, it was the exact same experience. And so not only now was I getting the exact same care that I was getting locally, I'm having to drive 2 hours one way to get to it at this point. And so we drove.
And once you're in labor, you're like, now I have to drive 2 hours?
Yeah.
Is that kind of that, like what the mindset was?
That was the plan. That was the plan. But what happened, I started having hypertension and so I ended up on bed rest. And so we were able to induce at 39 weeks because, and so I didn't have to go into labor. They induced me at 39 weeks, but it was, you know, to get there, and have the exact same experience, I just started to feel like, well, that was a complete waste of time to transition when it was the exact same care. And I mean, it was just, I think people see the diagnosis and they just feel like this is all we can do. You know, this is it. And it was the same narrative in both locations. And so I felt like, why am I driving 4 hours, you know, for the same thing that I was getting driving 20 minutes away, you know? So.
Yeah. Especially as a busy parent, a professional, like you had a lot going on. So I think that, you know, is just adding to your day and just being pregnant and all of the symptoms that go with that and the tiredness and everything. You said that it was a different pregnancy experience than your other kids. You know, it's like, you know, I've already learned so much from you. I can't believe how fast the time has gone. You know, we're talking a lot about like your pregnancy experience and, you know, that kind of makes sense because I'm coming from a prenatal genetic counseling perspective. But please tell me more about Elijah. I mean, he's such a cute, almost 7-year-old kid. What makes him happy? You know, what's maybe something that recently came up that just kind of made everybody in the family crack up? Like, tell me more about Elijah.
Elijah is a complete mess. He is a pistol. He has his own little personality. He is doing everything they told us that he would not. You know, just yesterday, Elijah went to get fitted for new braces and shoes because he started taking steps independently. I mean, he is doing so, so well. He loves to play ball. And three of my other kids still live at home. And so he loves just interacting with them. You know, he has his own communication style. He doesn't have, you know, traditional words, but he will get your attention. He loves music. He likes to sit and watch, you know, movies. I think he loves the independence of his gait trainer. I mean, he is writing his own story. He truly is. He's such a good little kid. Well, I guess to some degree he is a little kid. You know, in my mind, he's still the baby, but all of my kids, I still say babies.
Right.
But he is just, I mean, he's.
That is true.
He's a big boy. He is.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's so cute. And it must just be so heartwarming of just the way that all of your kids kind of interact together. You know, I hear that a lot from parents of a child that has a condition of just like the way that they fit into the family and very much an important part and can often just kind of be the light in the family is what I hear a lot. And that kind of sounds like, you know, what Elijah brings to your family dynamic. And yeah, definitely no matter how old he is, it sounds like he'll always be the baby because if you're the last kid, you're just always going to be the baby,
right?
I think, especially with that many siblings.
Yeah.
And I wanted to kind of talk about, you started this really cool foundation, EWE Foundation. I'd love to hear how you guys support your fellow members of the Trisomy 18 community. I mean, how did you start getting involved with the community and then start the foundation? What is some of the goals that you have in terms of, like, you know, supporting fellow members?
You know, so for us, we started the foundation, honestly, because of the gaps in care that we received. I think initially our goal was to provide some level of bereavement support because those were the conversations that we were having. And we wanted to remove some of the financial burden that comes with having to bury your child. And that was after talking to our life insurance company and learning all the fine print that comes with having a child die. And so, you know, Elijah continued to live, and honestly, the foundation continued to grow. We use him as our blueprint. You know, our biggest goal is health literacy. We want families to understand the trisomy 18 information that's out there, and even we support other rare disease communities as well. But we want families to know the information that's out there. We want them to be able to understand it when folks are giving it to them. And there are some, you know, there's just some literacy gaps in people being able to understand and interpret what doctors are telling them. It's important to us that families make informed decisions. In order for them to do that, they have to have access to all the information, all the alternative solutions, all the treatment outcomes. I think for us too, it was really important to really fuse in that mental health piece, that comfort care piece. We spent the first 6.5 months of Elijah's life in hospice care. And so, we were not receiving services outside of hospice. When we started pursuing things ourselves, it was because, you know, my background is in healthcare administration, and I knew how to sift through medical records and look for diagnoses and what specialists to call. And so we want to empower families to be able to do that same thing, even if they don't have a background in healthcare. And so it's really, really important that we help families understand that language as best we can, and give them the tools they need to help doctors coordinate their care and not feel excluded from the decision-making process. And then lastly, we really wanted to provide some level of assistance. One of our programs, we do have financial assistance because let's be fair, you know, it costs to have a child with extensive medical conditions. And so we wanted to remove some of the burden of financial disparity and financial hardship. And we provide some level of financial assistance for families in economic hardship. We also have, you know, partnerships with legal folks and lawyers who can help families understand, you know, how to navigate that piece, special needs trusts and different things like that, special education, if their kid is fortunate enough to make it to the school system, understanding special education and the IEP process. And so so we have like a lot of different programs and initiatives that we've just slowly incorporated. If we've experienced it with Elijah, and we had a slight struggle, or if we had really, really great success and we think another family may have a challenge based on where they live, for example, we figure out a way to infuse it into what we do. So families know that those resources are out there. Simple things, early intervention. We found out about early intervention when Elijah was 2 and you age out at 3, but he could have received it at birth.
Yeah, like a birth to 3 program.
Yeah. And so we want families to know that those resources are out there, whether we are the host of those resources or we are in partnership with an organization who provides those resources. We just want folks to know that they're there.
Wow. It's almost like, what don't you do for people that are in the community? You know, it's like, that is just, Sarita, that is just so amazing. And I love that you're taking what you have learned of being Elijah's mom and patient advocate, and also with your background in healthcare administration. I mean, that is so useful. And I cannot imagine how instrumental that has been in understanding what you're eligible for through insurance or other programs. And then being able to share that with other caregivers of people with trisomy 18 is just, I mean, it's phenomenal. There's just, you know, I think one of the things that you said that I really want to pull out is there's a lack of education around trisomy 18. And there's a lot of misconceptions that, you know, I don't want to mislead people that there is a high chance, unfortunately, for miscarriages and stillbirth. And I know that you've used that language in your own resources and on your own podcast, Being Rare podcast. But also, there is just such limited information for those that do make it to hospital discharge and do go home. And it's like, what then? You were so focused on, well, what could happen during pregnancy and delivery and after delivery. You know, it's like, all right, now what? And I think just the fact that, you know, EWE Foundation that you have started with your partner is just phenomenal that this is available. And there's just so much to learn. And a lot of people can learn for your podcast, as I mentioned, Being Rare. It's just amazing. I certainly could talk to you for all day, but you know, thank you so much for coming on, Sarita. This has just been amazing. And I really encourage people to check out EWE Foundation, especially for people that are students that are learning about trisomy 18, that may be going into prenatal and being in a position like me where I'm sharing this information with people. And I think the psychosocial component and just having the patient lead the way in terms of the conversations and what they want is just so, so important. And that's something that I really try to focus on as their healthcare provider. But Sarita, you're amazing. You are such a role model. And you. I love it. Elijah's so lucky to have you as a parent.
Thank you.
You're just such a light. Thank you so much for just bringing on this energy and your enthusiasm. And just being very genuine.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate it. I'm so glad that a colleague shared your podcast with me. And so we just totally had to connect. I'm so glad she did. And I'm so glad you and I have connected.
We totally had to. We got that email and I was like, Sarita's coming on the show. I don't know when, but it's going
to
happen.
Right. I'm so glad to be here. I appreciate you so much.
Yes. And for those that are going to be checking out her podcast, because you will, being Rare Podcast, I'm going to be on an episode as well. So you guys can check that out. We're going to kind of be talking about the prenatal genetic counseling side. So we're going to switch the sides of the mic here and everything. But thank you so much, Sarita, for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
For more information about today's episode, visit dnatoday.com, where you can also stream all 200 plus episodes of the show, including video versions of interviews recorded in 2021 or later. Any questions, episode ideas, guest pitches, or sponsor inquiries can be sent into info@dnatoday.com. Be sure to follow us on social media, especially so you don't miss a giveaway. We are at DNA Today Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, and more. Please rate and review the podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. This truly helps us climb the charts and allow more genetic nerds like yourself to find the show. Here's a bonus. If you do and send us a screenshot, I'll give you a shout out on the show. DNA Today is created, hosted, and produced by myself, Kira Dineen. Our team includes communications lead, Corinne Merlino, video lead, Amanda Andrioli, outreach intern, Sonia Tanaker, social media intern, Kajal Patel, and graphic designer, Ashlyn Anokian. Thanks for listening, and join us next time to discover new advances in the world of genetics.
The genes of you and me, the genes of you and me, we're all made of DNA. We're all made of the same chemical DNA.